Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a newsworthy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Newsworthy, as in, I read something in the news, and not only did I learn something new, but what I learned was important and will subsequently create change or action. Let's be honest, the news today may be interesting and sometimes dramatic. It's meant to poke at you and provoke you to click more. I often click at both Fox and CNN to observe the incredible divergent spin on identical stories. There is very little original reporting and rather dishing out the political talking points of the day. But once in a while, there comes along a new story that is truly newsworthy. The reporter did research, went undercover, dug deep, spent time and money, and discovered something important that deserves action. Newsworthy stories for High Truths include the discovery of illicit fentanyl sold in Mexican pharmacies, deadly drugs sold on Craigslist, or smoke shops selling chocolate magic mushrooms that contain bath salts. To learn more about newsworthy reports, I reach out to someone who authored such stories, Connor Sheets. Connor Sheets delivered newspapers as a teenager and today is on a different side of the news cycle as an investigative and enterprise reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He received numerous awards for his writing and his discoveries resulted in powerful federal and international response. To learn more about Connor Sheets, check out the High Truth show notes. Connor Sheets, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I've been waiting for this conversation for a while. It's interesting. I love this because you contacted me months ago to do a report and we had like amazing conversation. I thought I'm going to turn the tables and ask to interview you. And so now I get to do that. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I'm interested to see what we'll end up chatting about. Thank you.
So you started your life delivering newspapers as a teenager, which by the way, I did. I was 12 years old and I had a little paper out and I was rolling the papers and had it on my bicycles and threw them in front of people's doors. Is that what you did?
Yeah, I actually used a wagon. It was a friend of mine and I, and we kind of just had them in the back of the wagon, roll them up and throw them in people's drawers. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, fun times. I had to go collect my own money. I was not good at that.
Oh, yeah. We didn't have to do that. I think we got lucky on that front.
But I'm wondering, you started out with newspapers, delivering them, and then you ended up writing for newspapers. Is there a connection there?
Not particularly. Honestly, I wanted to write novels. I went to college as an English major and realized about halfway through that, you know, I liked writing, but I didn't think that fiction was really the way to go. And I tried out journalism and then it's all the rest is history, whatever you want to call it. Like, I mean, I just really fell in love with journalism and it's stuck with that since then. Yeah.
Real life is so much more interesting than fiction, right?
Yeah, I mean, I love fiction, but it's like, yeah, there's something about talking to people and getting out there and you know, participating in the world, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Now, your reporting style is very different. You're an investigative and enterprise reporter. And what does that mean?
So I'm the only person at the LA Times that has this title. I don't think it's a very common title. It's a mix of two different styles of reporting. So it's investigative, which is, a little more something people are more familiar with, where basically, you know, trying to uncover wrongdoing or try to address injustices, that type of thing. And then enterprise is sort of a term that I think within journalism is fairly well known. I mean, it means sort of like kind of work that maybe takes a little bit longer, but sort of tells, you know, sort of feature type writing or longer form, or sort of just stories that are kind of, you know, the author comes up with and think kind of following your interests. And so my job, I mean, I tell people my job is sort of writing about a little bit about everything, but it's not really general assignment. It's sort of like more, more sort of like bigger topics, more in depth, things. So I sort of end up, instead of having a beat, I sort of kind of investigate or write about a wide range of topics. It's an interesting gig.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I find that it's rare, because if you like turn on the TV or your iPad and watch the news or pick up most reports, it's just really, it seems like it's copying someone else's work and just kind of talking points. And what you do is much different.
Yeah, and I think newspapers have that role to some degree. I mean, still, I mean, obviously at one point newspapers drove the narrative to a greater degree, but I think, you know, newspapers still have people out there pounding the pavement and finding new information every day. And obviously local TV stations and stuff. But I think a lot of what people encounter in a daily, in their daily interactions with news content is sort of more like entertainment, sort of like, you know, the cable news channels, like they have an important role. They get information out to people, but a lot of that is very retreading. You know, it's a lot of retreading stuff that's already been reported. And, you know, I think also, you know, the internet allows for endless reiterations of the same content. So I think you're right that that does happen. But at the same time, I still think there's people gathering news and coming up with new stuff.
Right. And you're one of them working for the LA Times. And what is that like? It's do they have a bigger budget? Do they have an agenda? Do they dictate to you what you should be doing? How much freedom do you have in your reporting?
Yeah, so again, like as an investigative and enterprise reporter, I might have a different answer as far as how much freedom I have than someone who's, you know, really on a strict beat. But, you know, so for me, I have very little dictating going on. I mean, sometimes I have, there's things that, you know, someone's out of the office. A lot of times I'll play cleanup duty, which, you know, like, okay, someone's out of the office this month and they're, but for right now, I'm actually writing quite a bit about the LA County DA's office race because our reporter's out on paternity leave. So, so, you know, sometimes I'll do that kind of thing. And, you know, that, I guess that's in some way dictating. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, we don't have any kind of vision, you know, any kind of editorial stance that's dictated to us. We're not forced to write about X, Y, or Z issue. Our editorial board and our opinion page is completely separate. And we get essentially from, you know, from my experience over 3 years here, never had any, you know, interference from anyone other than, you know, my editor might say, can you rewrite this? I don't like the way this is written, you know, as far as grammar or, you know, story structure, but it really doesn't happen on the issues level. And then as you said, as far as budget, I mean, you know, LA Times has quite a nice budget for a newsroom, but at the same time, you know, like every organization in journalism, you know, somewhat seeing declining revenues and that type of thing. So that's just the reality of the news biz nowadays. So I don't think it's necessarily any worse than many other publications, but it's just a reality of how it is.
Yeah, because I noticed, and we'll talk about your specific stories, but that it probably took some money to do the depth and investigation that you were able to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's like you were talking about how a lot of what you encounter in the news space nowadays is just kind of retread, you know, re-aggregated content or that type of thing. And I think obviously that's a lot cheaper to do. But I think if you want to make an impact and really shine a light on something, sometimes it really does take money for travel or for just time. You know, time itself is an investment of money with multiple journalists all working on the same thing. And you know, that's always been a part of journalism. And you know, the more that you can invest in it, the more new and important content you can come up with, you know.
So LA Times has a reputation of having a political slant. Do you feel that in your stories? Or if you're like talking about marijuana, it's like, oh, we can't touch that subject. We're pro-legalization or anything like that. Do you feel that in your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is something that comes up quite a lot. I've never felt that at any of my journalism jobs I've had. I mean, occasionally you'll have like an editor who doesn't realize that they have some strong biases. I haven't had that at the LA Times, but you know, you'll have someone who kind of obviously is approaching it from one side or the other, but they don't even realize it. I've never encountered someone purposely saying, oh, we can't touch this topic or that topic because of political considerations or something. And I think, you know, a lot of the reputation that X journalism organization might have, LA Times, like for instance, Wall Street Journal is a great example. They have a fairly conservative editorial board, but then, you know, they won a Pulitzer for the Stormy Daniels stuff with Donald Trump. So, I mean, there's completely separate entities, the editorial board and the newsroom. And that's similar at the LA Times. Of course, there's going to be, I don't believe there's anything completely bias-free. So, for instance, which story do we put on top of the newspaper or on top of the website? Someone has to make that decision. I mean, the only way you can make a decision is by collecting information and having some form of way of interpreting it. So, you know, you're going to end up with a slight slant, but it's not something that's enforced. It's not something I've ever in my entire career encountered. I think you might see that a little more at some of the bigger networks. But, you know, again, I think journalists are pretty, you know, I don't even want to say that about the network. I mean, you know, if you have something like MSNBC or Fox News, where, you know, they have a pretty explicit, it's pretty obvious what's going on there as far as the bias, you know, one way or the other. I think you'll see that more in those type of places. But I mean, honestly, journalists are pretty principled. And, you know, when there is something where, like, you know, in Las Vegas, the Review Journal newspaper, their owner, not remembering all the details exactly, but tried to force some type of content to be, some kind of story to be done, or I forget exactly what it was. And they basically revolted. And that's typically what happens when you see that type of thing, because, you know, it would be quite the conspiracy for everyone to be on board with hiding some agenda, you know. So
yeah, well, it seems like your agenda is just undercovering, like you said, these wrongs that the public needs to be about. Let's talk a little bit about some of your stories. And like I told you, Connor, as far as people reporting stuff and the information that you have talked about has probably made more an impact in my profession than any stories I could think of. Like, it had a direct impact in how I, you know, approach being a doctor. So I am very impressed. And I just want to go some of those stories to give an example. You reported about American tourists going to Mexico and dying from pills bought in Mexican pharmacies. Okay, that's an interesting story. But that resulted in federal health warnings, shutting down pharmacies. You know, you had a national and international reach. That's pretty impressive. So can you take us a little bit behind the scenes and how you discovered this? What was your lead? How did that happen?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's very kind. But I worked on these with Carrie Blakinger. It's a series of stories that we did last year. Carrie Blakinger, one of my colleagues, and Brittany Mejia, another colleague. And Carrie received a tip from someone who had been to Mexico, a source, someone she knows who had been there recently at the beginning of last year. I think they just come, maybe it was December or January, going into the beginning of last year. And they had been in Cabo and they'd purchased, this is someone who, you know, uses drugs and had purchased an Oxycontin pill and tested it and found out that, you know, and it came up for fentanyl, and that was the initial impetus, you know, and you know, we just kind of had this one sort of anecdote that this was happening. And then we kind of found out that UCLA was looking at it. We talked to them a little bit, but then sort of separately did our own reporting. And, you know, Carrie and I did the initial visit. You know, I didn't expect that we were even going to be sort of, you know, clear to do this. It doesn't have a clear California angle. We're trying to, you know, LA Times, we really try to focus on things that directly impact California. But I mean, obviously there's the potential for uncovering some really important issues. And what we started to see was we had that initial tip. And, you know, before you go on a trip where you're going to spend thousands of dollars and travel all around and have a whole work week dedicated to something, we do, you know, pre-reporting is what we call it, where we say, is this going to be fruitful? Is it, you know, we got to kind of demonstrate that it's going to have, you know, if we go down there and there's nothing to report on, it's kind of a waste. So we ended up finding a pretty good strategy that we followed throughout the 8 trips to Mexico, which was before we would go, we'd sort of look on Google Maps, Reddit, various, you know, Yelp, various sites that have reviews and postings and things like that about different pharmacies and sort of get little hints. Like, so you'd see, you know, I bought, X medication at this pharmacy, and then I ended up passed out on the floor all night or whatever. You'll find stuff like that in like little, especially Google reviews for some reason, but people kind of post about their experiences, or they'd say this is the shadiest pharmacy I've ever been to.
Do you go like undercover? Do you have like a fake name and say, hey, where do I buy good stuff?
So yeah, it's interesting. So when we first started out, the first trips were to Tijuana and then Cabo. And, you know, so starting out, we kind of, I mean, honestly, we mostly just sort of we never said that we weren't anything. We just kind of chose to look like tourists. So, you know, which we are, I mean, you know,
yeah,
we are,
not too
we are
hard
tourists,
to fake.
But, you know, just try to, you know, not trying to look, you know, just, you know, shorts and, you know, t-shirt and, you know, whatever, and just sort of look the part of all the other tourists that are in these places. And, you know, it never got to a conversation like that. You know, no one really ever, there's no reason to suspect that we were doing anything other
but
than.
But how about online? Did you like put in chats and stuff like that and ask?
Oh, yeah. Well, so in written communication, we always identify as journalists pretty much. So I don't know that there was any time where we had to surreptitiously interview anyone. I mean, I think there are places where that's helpful, but I mean, I think in this case, I mean, you know, there was really no reason for that. But I mean, it was interesting because we kind of, when we went back to Tijuana and Cabo towards the end of the time, now we know, you know, all these, there's been raids of pharmacies all across the country. We published numerous stories about it. Our names are out there, our faces. So that, then we kind of dressed a little different. So hoping that maybe we won't, you know, get recognized and, you know, make someone mad, you know. So there was some undercover aspect, but it was mostly just for, we never lied about who we were. We just sort of didn't say anything, you know. So it was interesting.
So you went several times to Cabo San Tijuana?
So we went to Mexico 8 times, and the first 6 times were all the first time we'd gone to those places. And then we realized towards the end, we got some reporting, we got some tips from people in Mexico, or sort of heard from people that were saying, you know, they're shutting. So we, you know, we're getting these alerts from the Mexican government or from law enforcement that they've shut down 20, you know, they've shut down 30 pharmacies in Cabo this week, and they've shut down 10 and whatever. And so we went back to Cabo, Tijuana, and Puerto Vallarta. And basically the concept was, are they actually shutting these places down? Are they staying shut down? Like, it's great if you shut a place down, but if they just reopen the next day, then really what's the impact? And should they be, you know, I mean, so we decided to go back to those 3 cities for that purpose. And also, while we were in those cities that last time, we actually identified as reporters before we left the city. You know, we went in, bought pills, tested them, and then came back and said, as reporters, you know, what do you have to say about the fact that these pills have fentanyl and that type of thing, which we hadn't done previously. So that was pretty interesting, a little more nerve-wracking. But
wow, that is to yeah. Confront someone like that. What did you use for testing? Did you use fentanyl testing strips, or did you have like a little mass spectrometer?
Yeah, so it's funny, it evolved over time. You know, we never anticipated at the beginning that we'd be going 8 times and doing the volume of testing and spending the thousands and thousands of dollars on these pills that we ended up spending. So at first, we really didn't even know much about it. We didn't have any contacts. We just went down with fentanyl test strips and tested these pills, fentanyl and meth test strips, or amphetamine test strips too. And that was our earliest stuff. But then pretty quickly we realized we wanted more, like, you know, a better analysis, because people were saying, oh, you know, these test strips are fallible. You know, it really kind of, there's people sort of
tried to debunk that.
They are fallible to some degree, but like in a way that a mass spectrometer is not. So we ended up linking up with a lab, which, you know, we haven't really said who the lab was, but basically it's a very well-known lab, not well-known, but a well-established lab that has a lot of the protocols to test for a lot of these things. And at first we had only like qualitative testing, like, is there meth in here? Is there fentanyl? And by the time we got to the end of the year, we were getting everything quant tested. So we were actually able to see how much of everything was in these products, which is really, really interesting. Was, you know, rather than just dipping the thing in and you see, oh yes, there's fentanyl, hopefully it's working correctly. By the end, we really knew how much there was of everything. So.
Right. And all the other stuff that's in it too.
Correct. Yes. Yep.
All right. That's interesting. All right. So here you're this, you know, investigative journalist doing all this work that's impactful. You're reporting on it. Is law enforcement asking you about this? Because this is kind of their job too, or should be.
I would say we were more asking law enforcement about it. There was quite a bit of essentially ignoring our reporting going on, frankly. So first of all, the State Department is the entity within the US government that calculates, keeps data on deaths abroad. And they never, to this day, gave us any data on how many people have died from pills bought in pharmacies in Mexico. They wouldn't give us data on how many people died.
I don't think they know that. Would they?
But I mean, even like as far as like overdose deaths, like they just really wouldn't give us any information. And so we are still in the records process. You know, we'd love to still have some of that information. There was a congressional, I don't want to misstate this. It's a provision within the budgetary process last year that passed that was supposed to make it so they had to release all this information. We're still trying to figure out where that ended up. I mean, it kind of passed as part of a minibus bill, it's called, not an omnibus, but it doesn't seem that they've released that information yet, or if they have, they've only released it to the Congress.
I'd be surprised if they have that data.
Yeah, well, I mean, even just like how many people died in Mexico and what was the cause of death. I mean, there's not that many tourists dying in Mexico. So, you know, we're specifically saying Americans dying in Mexico. Just give us a list of, you know, and we don't need names, we don't need genders. If you could just tell us who died in which places, and we could try to backtrack and see if it lines up with our findings and that type of thing. But, you know, my opinion, it's public data. I understand, you know, health, you know, we have to protect medical information. So as far as like names, and even if you don't want to say cause of death that directly, but what the point I was making was, as far as law enforcement. So, you know, the DEA, obviously, their stance is that they don't operate in other countries. And, you know, I mean, I think that we've seen in the past that the DEA does operate in other countries, but, you know, officially they don't. And, you know, they didn't want to share their tactics with us, that type of thing. But at the same time, the Mexican government was sort of the Mexican government wasn't communicating with us too much. They did it first and they kind of dropped off towards the end. But, you know, they're doing all these raids and stuff. So we're seeing that something's happening. You know, the military was involved in some of them and that type of thing. So, but the DEA would not really respond to us for quite a while. So we just had to keep putting in our stories, you know, we declined to comment. And it got to the point where the administrator of the DEA, Milgram, she was at a, we found out that she was going to be at a press, at a conference in LA, in Beverly Hills. And we actually went to it, sat through Sarah Huckabee Sanders' speech before her speech, and sat right in the front. As soon as she was done, we walked up and said, "Hey, you know, do you have any thoughts on our reporting?" And we actually basically got ushered aside by security, which is in one of our stories. Because, I mean, in my opinion, you know, what is your job if not to respond to, you know, threats to American health and that type of thing? And they just refused to do it. So it was pretty disappointing on that. And not particularly shocking, but disappointing.
Okay, so it took them a while for you to be persistent, and good for you. Because I don't know, I wear the public health hat. Like, we need to know this, like whatever the people, right. the public needs that warning. So you were at LA Times providing that public health warning, at least. I don't know how much it got through, but it eventually.
And at least the State Department did issue a dedicated health warning on this. So they actually did respond publicly in that sense, but the DEA really, really did not do much.
Right. And did they ever come around?
No. I mean, they really never acknowledged it really at all. I don't want to speak completely. I mean, maybe there's a tiny bit here or there, but I mean, it was very minimal.
But at the end of the day, your reporting had the impact. I don't know how many stories you did on that one subject, but pharmacies were shut down and you were checking out to see whether they really shut down. And these health alerts came out. I know we were talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, LA County put one out, the State Department put one out. I mean, I think that, you know, hopefully that information got out there. We got a lot of response from people. I think it was fairly well read broadly within the public. I mean, I think it's something that's out in the ether now.
Yeah.
I think people might have even just seen the headline, and when they're in Mexico, they say, is it worth getting a oxygen? Like one of the guys we interviewed, who he's, I think from LA, is actually a pharmacist, was in Mexico, got a very bad bee sting apparently. And like it, I guess it was, you know, not the average bee sting, it was like a pretty bad one. And so he went to the pharmacy and asked for like Tylenol, and they said, we have this painkiller. And I guess it was I forget it was Oxycontin or whatever. And I don't know why he thought that was a good idea to take that, but he ended up taking one and almost died. And it's, you know, he said that, you know, now I think that people might have that extra moment where they say, maybe I'll just skip it this time. You know what I mean? It's not that important, you know? And I think that's the most you can ask for, is, you know, for it to be something that's out there where.
Yeah, that
extra step will save lives, I think.
It does save lives because, you know, being in San Diego at a border time, prescription medications are extremely expensive. It's not uncommon for people to go to Mexico to buy their medications, and to know that you can't count on what's in there is important.
Yeah.
So anyway, what a great congratulations for that. And by the way, were you surprised by the success of this story and the impact? Or yeah, you were, I mean, it sounds like you were frustrated, like things didn't happen fast enough.
I mean, I think the State Department pretty quickly put out that public health warning, which had never been done on that topic before. We pretty quickly started to compile stories of people some of whose stories had never been told publicly or had only been told in very local media, of people who'd actually died from this. So I don't know that we were surprised. I mean, I think we would have liked more to have happened at some level. I think, you know, there was supposed to be money dedicated towards this. There was supposed to be, you know, I mean, I think there's more that should be done. If, you know, I think if this was happening in the US, it would be a massive scandal in a way that, but you know, I mean, living in LA, people are going to Cabo and Tijuana and these places so frequently, just American tourists, never mind. I mean, the thing is, you know, one question people always ask is, well, why didn't you look at Mexican pharmacies? And when we, you know, ones that serve the local population. And when we went into those pharmacies, almost literally unfailingly, they would say, you know, what are you talking about? Like, we don't sell that type of thing here. And every tourist pharmacy you went to, they're openly advertising that they sell it. So there's a big difference there. So I think, you know, it's worth pointing that out, that, you know, this really was targeted at tourists. And so the concept that just because it's in Mexico, there's so many people going to Mexico in a given time, you know, from all around the world who need this information. And it never made too much sense to me why, I don't know if there was, what the reasoning for not putting this more out into the world and spreading the information about this was, but you know, that was a little disappointing. I thought you would hope that the powers that be in this public health and drug, you know, addressing space would see the benefit of spreading this over whatever the reasons for not doing so are, you know?
Yeah. Sorry. So you talked to DEA, or you tried to talk to DEA kind of, and State Department. Did you ever interact with my old stomping ground, the Office of National Drug Control Policy?
Yeah. So the first story we did, I think we quoted them. And after that, I think we didn't have too much success, or I don't know that we kept the conversation going as much. I think they didn't really have as much. I think if I'm remembering correctly, this is over a year ago. I'm not remembering exactly, but I think their kind of stance was, you know, this is more of a question for the State Department or the DEA, but they were helpful.
But they oversee them.
I don't remember all the details. Okay, I think they kind of gave us a person at the DEA or something. I'm not remembering exactly, but we did interact with them to some degree.
Annoying.
Sorry.
All right. Another story. LA homeless agencies mismanage funds, not using $150 million. Are you a forensic accountant too, or how did that come about?
Oh, well, how did that story come about? I'm trying to remember. There's this program called the Emergency Housing Vouchers. And, you know, I had been talking to people in the homelessness services space about these vouchers, and that, you know, I sort of heard, you know, homelessness was an issue I was looking at a lot at the time. And I'd sort of heard about these vouchers and how, you know, people were saying that basically there's a number of people who were saying they had them, but they couldn't use them because of the government, various agencies in the county and city were not moving fast enough. And basically, you know, the person who's the main character in that story, she had a voucher. So she's been homeless for 30 years. And she's been basically living in Skid Row, and she had this voucher, which is given out by the federal government. We've got, you know, does, you know, tens of millions of dollars worth of these vouchers that are supposed to be to fund housing for people experiencing homelessness. And so she got one, you know what I mean? Like, she went through the process, did everything needed. She found an apartment in this building in downtown LA, and that was willing to accept her, her voucher, all that. Everything was lined up. The only thing that needed to happen was the county, or I'm forgetting if it's the county or the city, had to come and look at the, physically look at the apartment. It's a one room apartment. It's a studio, like literally probably just had to do this. Does it have a bathroom? Does it have XYZ? And that was, for months, she wasn't able to get anyone to do it. She went to the offices, she called, you know, endlessly. And this is a pretty representative story. There's a bunch of people that had stories like this, but she was willing to like give us access to her life and go on the record. But, you know, she ended up losing her voucher. And then what was interesting is, as soon as the story came out, of course, they're able to figure it out and get her housed. So really, it seems like there was some kind of bureaucratic backlog or refusal to move quickly or whatever it was, that as soon as, you know, there's a public light on it, you know, there's a light on it in the public, all of a sudden it's able to be fixed. But, you know, so then we, you know, once I found out that this was happening in isolated cases, I mean, it's actually not that hard to find the information about how much money was supposed to be spent on this. And then sort of with some records requests and that type of thing, how much had been used and how much hadn't. And, you know, it was over $100 million, nearly $150 million that, you know, was supposed to go to these people that, you know, we talk about homelessness being, I don't know that there's any issue bigger in LA County as far as public perception and politics and all that. I mean, it's about as big an issue as it gets. We want to do everything we can for it. But then at the same time, the federal government's literally giving us money to house people, and we're sending tens of millions of dollars back a year. And so that's what that story was about. Pretty yeah. disheartening story.
Yeah, but important. Like, and then, like you said, when you shed a light on it, you could just instantly fix it. And I think that speaks to the important partnership we have with journalists and media and public health messaging.
Yeah, totally.
Boba Fett. Never heard of that. Bluefish fettuccine. I would think that that's like Alfredo spaghetti sauce. But this was another one of your stories about drugs being sold on Craigslist. That is crazy. Tell us about how that happened. And are you shopping for drugs on Craigslist?
Yeah. So drugs being sold on Craigslist is something that's been happening for like 20 years or more. But fentanyl was what was interesting here. So obviously fentanyl being the most deadly drug risk right now. You know, if there's someone selling weed on Craigslist, I mean, who really cares at the end of the day? But what happened here was, essentially, so we have a few sources, some of which were from the fentanyl reporting, and they were sort of saying, look, you know, we're seeing it, for a while, I guess fentanyl wasn't appearing on certain. It was, so there's a whole storyline about Snapchat was where you could buy, like, kids were buying fentanyl,
and there's a lawsuit whatever. Against them for right. you know, facilitating deaths on Snapchat.
Absolutely, and that was like a huge sort of media thing. Also, in addition to the reality of like people dying from it, like that became a big focus. Snapchat, and beyond Snapchat, there's also sort of a lesser version of that on Instagram and Telegram, as far as like attention to those. And it seems like, and like even sites like OfferUp, which is like this, like an e-commerce platform, similar to like a Poshmark or something. Those places, as the reporting came out that people, or the, you know, investigations or whatever it was, that people were dying from buying drugs on those platforms, you kind of saw like a response from them to sort of try to clean it up. And maybe it wasn't always the most robust response, but at least you're seeing something, right? And then somehow Craigslist and is over on the side, continuing to be this marketplace for it. And it just kind of required having a little bit of knowledge about the terminology. And so, yeah, I mean, in talking to people that we, you know, sources of ours who use fentanyl or who are past users of fentanyl or are just very well, you know, even drug researchers who are really acquainted with some of these terms, we kind of went from those kind of street sources to the drug researchers instead. You know, what do these things mean? You know, it's, we can very well say, you know, blue Roxy board shorts. Oh, obviously that means Roxycontins or whatever, but to have, you know, we want to have an expert that can kind of verify it. So anyways, we spent quite a bit of time just kind of trolling around Craigslist, trying to find what was out there. And I mean, it was really a large number of postings that were kind of coming and going over a period of time. Like, there was a pretty consistent, barrage of these posts advertising.
Now, what did Craigslist have to say for themselves?
So I don't really think they gave much of a response, but we pretty quickly, as soon as we started asking questions about this, within, I don't want to put an exact time frame, but days, weeks, the story wasn't out yet, but we started seeing that a lot of the search terms that used this, that we were searching for were no longer autofilling. So when you go in Craigslist, you go into the I want to buy stuff section, basically, you put in Blue Roxy. It used to come up Blue Roxy 30 milligram and things like that, you know, and now when you put in blue, it just sort of won't autofill like that. So it's clearly something changed somehow. We were never able to nail down with them. Did they change the algorithm? How did it work? Did they block certain terms? We already know they block other terms, so it's possible to do. You know, you can't put in, like, I don't know, murder weapon, or I mean, there's like some basic term. You can't put in like prostitute. There's
Could you put in fentanyl or no?
Fentanyl, I mean, I don't know that fentanyl ever autocorrected that way. You know what I mean? I think they've had that one.
Did they just fix the word, or did they change it to something else? Like, I don't know, purple caterpillars. I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they found, I mean, we have checked back and there's still some stuff there. But, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, it's like whack-a-mole. Like, of course, if you block all these terms, then they'll just come up with new ones. But at the same time, some of these terms are old terms. You know, it's not like, you know, like calling Oxycontin blues has been a thing for like 15 years. It's not exactly, like Boba Fett, maybe that one, you know, some of these will get through, but it seemed clear that there was not enough done about the really obvious ones either.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, this work is so important, and it's something, you know, there's a role for you as journalist. Does law enforcement ever come to you for assistance? Because it seemed like the whole whack-a-mole, I'm sure they're maybe, or I hope there would be undercover agents looking at this stuff and trying to stop it. And for them to go to Craigslist and say something, you know, why don't you stop doing that? Maybe they'll do something about it. But if it's in the front of the LA Times, that's a different type of pressure, sometimes even more. Do the two of you guys ever work together?
Yeah, so I mean, we have to, you know, journalistically, we have some restrictions that I think are good in the concept of how much we work together with a government agency. I mean, I don't think we really ever work together in that sense. But at the same time, we definitely get a lot of information from them, and they see our reporting. So it's a lot of the times it's a one-way street, just because, like, just the nature of the news business. But in this case, the former DA administrator, the former DA head for LA was very helpful, because, you know, the DA currently, the current people there, you know, they have to go through their press office in DC, and everything gets sanitized down to these statements, which is how much of government works. It's not really been the knock on DEA. But the former DA guy, he kind of was able to talk to us and say, you know, when we were going after Snapchat, here's how we did it. And they did describe in detail. They were doing a lot of similar stuff to us, kind of just trolling around, trying to find stuff. And then they were, you know, he was honest. I mean, you know, if someone's selling small amounts of drugs on Snapchat, that might not be the DEA's focus. You know, that might be local police, and maybe they send it to local police, maybe not. But, you know, they were interested in finding the people who were behind, you know, that whole going up the chain type of thing. And so they would use these as leads to kind of bust up some of the bigger operations. So I think they are very aware of it. I mean, I was actually a little bit surprised, like, the level of knowledge that they had and were willing to talk about. It seems like they were, I mean, I think with Snapchat particularly, but I think, you know, when our story came out, I think they kind of, I don't know that there's been more enforcement since then. It's hard to track, but I mean, I think it probably put it back on their radar, because I think a lot of people sort of thought Craigslist was no longer cool to, like, post drugs on and stuff, and like, it had moved off of there. But I think because of the crackdowns on the other places, I think it had kind of risen again. And maybe we put that back on the radar. Who knows? They probably might have known the whole time.
Yeah. I've gone to talks by law enforcement where they're teaching parents all the different emoji language. Yeah. like if you see this on your kid's phone, like it's this is what these drugs mean. So that's important. Yeah. What about, and I don't know if you report about this, but the responsibility of social media, all these platforms on the issue of drugs. I mean, they are able to like control elections, right? And they are able to yeah. make sure that you don't, if you Google Donald Trump, it goes to Kamala Harris's whatever rally. They have control over these things. And I'm wondering if they feel that responsibility. I mean, this is the number one killer of Americans, 18 to 45. This is our biggest threat. Shouldn't they have more responsibility? Shouldn't our government be more on them to do more? And they're able to.
Yeah, I mean,
like, so I was saying offer up. I mean, that was an example of like what I would consider the ideal situation.
And
so
tell us again what offer up is, because I haven't heard of that, but I know that there was a big.
So offer up, I mean, I'm not super, I haven't used it myself, I don't think, but I mean, it's basically, if you know what Poshmark is, where you can kind of post used goods or whatever, anything, I guess. I don't know if it has to be used. And I guess you sort of like, if I remember correctly, you can like people, I don't know if it's almost like a, I don't really remember exactly how OfferUp works. It's essentially like an e-commerce site where you can sell stuff online. You know, like kind of like an eBay without the bidding, I guess. You know, and it's just sort of a way where you can kind of, I think it's local, basically, where you can kind of put in, I live in LA, I'm looking for, you know, pianos or whatever, or you can sell your own stuff. And so so OfferUp, I mean, I think it was a little more popular a few years ago. I mean, I think there's a world of people that are really into these sites. There's a ton of people on them, but it's not a very super well-known site. It's not a Craigslist or a Facebook or whatever, but it still has tons of users. And they were having a major problem after the Snapchat thing happened, where a ton of drugs were being sold there, fentanyl particularly, fentanyl pills, fentanyl-laced pills. And the DEA reached out to them. And they basically changed their algorithm or whatever they needed to change whatever, you know, they don't tell you exactly what they did, but the posts went away, basically. And that's all that really matters. Like, we don't really, who cares how they made it happen? Yeah. They figured out a way to get fentanyl off their site. And, you know, so it is disheartening when you see these others. I mean, you know, you look at a Snapchat or a Facebook or something like that. We're talking about multi-billion-dollar companies, whatever. I think they have legal exposure and risk and probably worried about class actions or who knows. So I think there's a lot of consider, you know, I think the best course of action would be to fix it, but I'm sure there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that is informing what their decision-making on it, you know, and I think they have a lot of plausible deniability of, you know, if you see fettuccine, whatever, like that's the reason that people are using these terms is because.
Because you know, you'll think it's Alfredo.
You're just selling pasta. What do you mean? You know, and it's like, it's a hard one. But I do think what's important on those type of stories, just raising awareness about like, this is out there. And
yeah. And let it happen, because then there'll be people like me saying, you need to do more. That's not okay. Yeah.
Right. And like you said, the government could put a little more pressure on. But I do think it has put pressure on, you know, we see what's happening with Snapchat. Yeah. Like I've said with OfferUp, but I think Craigslist is one that's somehow, it has like kind of this, a little bit of a mystique in a way. Like it's, you know, it's got 50 employees. It's only been in this one kind of weird office outside San Francisco for years. And, you know, it's, you know, who's Craig and all this, you know, has, I mean, I wouldn't say mystique is the right term, but it's a little more mysterious than like Google, you know what I mean? So I think there's been some, it just hasn't gotten the same scrutiny. And that's what we were hoping with this story. Like this same stuff we're getting mad at Snapchat about is also happening on Craigslist, but they're just getting.
I've used Craigslist. What is it? I bought a Mama Roo, like a newborn baby, like little swing thing. There.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. All right. So that's important. Again, I think, this is how your stories make an impact, because then it fires up a whole bunch of other people that saying, you know, that want to correct this injustice as well. If people just don't do the right thing on their own. San Diego stamps out illegal dispensaries. Why can't LA County? Are we doing such a great job in San Diego with pot? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, so on this specific topic of illegal dispensaries, it does seem that San Diego, which is a much smaller city, obviously, but still a major city, top 10 in the country by population, you know, somehow there's, and the county is a large county, obviously, with sprawling many, you know, it's a large city. We're not a county. We're not talking about, you know.
No, we're as big as some states.
Yeah, exactly. So so somehow the law enforcement and government entities there have made a decision that they wanted to do something about illegal dispensaries, and basically by taking a pretty interesting approach, which is really kind of what drew me into that story, is bringing all these different agencies, federal, local, state, whatever, bringing them all together and saying, how can we shut these places down? And they'll come in and they'll say, okay, we're going to put a lien against the building because of this, and we're going to turn off your water because we found that you dumped some stuff out back, and we're going to, whatever. There's all these different things they're doing to put the crunch on these places. And, you know, and actually we're going to need the name of the owner of this building who's now responsible for X alleged crimes, or else we're going to have to shut off this other, you know, shut off your electricity. And so it became really interesting. I mean, and, you know, that was an innovative approach, and it took some organization between various agencies and everything, but they were able to, I mean, according to the detective that I talked to, they haven't seen one, they haven't seen an illegal dispensary in months as of the time that story came out. Meanwhile, now there are tons of places where there's, you know, there's delivery services, there's street dealers, there's legal dispensaries, and then there's smoke shops where you can buy Delta 9 and some of these other cannabinoid type things. But LA County, on the other hand, is just rife with illegal dispensaries, which, as a person who reports on this, I didn't even know the ones in my town. I live in Torrance. I didn't know some of the ones here were illegal that I was writing about. You know, there's very little. I mean, once you know how to check if a dispensary is legal or not, it's fairly easy to do. And, you know, it's, you know, you could get to the bottom of it very quick, but there's very little information out there. I think people aren't really aware of this issue as much. And these places are advertising out in the open on the main streets in Compton, Torrance, Tarzana, whatever, like anywhere you go, they like, you're seeing these places and it's like, they're just openly operating. And, you know, there's a study that came out saying there's over 1,000 of them in LA, you know, close to 1,500. And, you know, driving around, it sounds like a crazy number. And then you drive around certain streets and there's four on one block. And so, you know, that's illegal cannabis dispensaries are an issue because you've got unlicensed cannabis, but you've also got the mushroom products, which is another story I did recently about unlicensed mushroom products and all the things that they're finding in those. And also there's a criminal element. I mean, a lot of this cannabis that's being sold in these places is being produced either by cartels or crime syndicates, according to, you know, people I've talked to, Chinese or Armenian crime syndicates and those type of things. And, you know, you're supporting those. And a lot of people don't even know that they're going to illegal dispensaries. Also, the other part about it that's a problem is it undercuts the legal industry so much. So when the prices are a quarter of the price of the legal places, it's very hard for those legal places to make it. So that kind of undercuts this whole thing of legal cannabis is going to, you know, bring in tax revenue and everything. It's interesting. I have a story that's publishing in the next couple of days or the next week or so about the cannabis industry in Michigan compared to California. Michigan just passed, this is not out as a story yet, but Michigan just passed California as the largest cannabis market in the country by volume. So not by sales, because it costs a lot more here, but by, so like the dollar amount of cannabis sold each year.
More than Oregon? I thought Oregon was like number one cannabis.
It depends on the metrics. So if you're looking, California is the biggest, sells the highest dollar amount. Like it's hundreds of millions of dollars more than Michigan. You know, I think it's like 900 million to 400 million, something.
More consumers per population or something like that.
Maybe per capita, that's definitely possible. But this is volume of cannabis sold. So Michigan has like a quarter of the number of people as California. There's more people in LA County alone. There's 4 million people more in LA County alone than Michigan, you know. But Michigan is now selling more volume of cannabis to people, you know, the legal industry is selling more than California. And it gets at a lot of these interesting issues. Why is that happening? First of all, one part of it is these illegal cannabis places are, and deeply entrenched street dealers and that type of thing. All the other ways you can get cannabis in LA County or in California, it's just a much bigger industry here than it is in Michigan. But also the prices. Michigan has some of the cheapest cannabis in the country, some of the lowest taxes, some of the lowest regulatory burdens. You can buy 2.5 ounces at a time versus however much here. I think it's 1 ounce. You know, every metric you can look at, Michigan's making it easier for the legal industry. And, you know, so I went to a place in Michigan and you know, you could buy 28 1-gram joints for, I think, $50. And here, I think you could buy like three, you know. So it's very interesting just seeing how, you
like
know,
our gas think, prices.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and you would expect like some difference, but the difference is so vast, and it leads to people buying less of it. And, you know, I mean, whether, you know, we can have a conversation about is buying more and less cannabis good or bad, but it's just shocking to me that it's, that somehow Michigan has surpassed California. So very interesting.
That is very interesting. And again, how much more I learned from you than so many other places. Just on a webinar last week with Michigan Public Health and the head of their Bureau of Cannabis, and you know, really talking about how much they want to have their own lab to test the products and all these other things. And,
oh, wow.
And but I just learned more from you in a few minutes than I did listening to a whole day webinar from them.
Wow, that's interesting.
But, you know, because when you said, oh, San Diego is doing such a better job than LA, I also wonder about, we're talking about the illegal shops and you need to have license and certification. I was also thinking about the illegal grows, because I still think that the legal shops buy their stuff from illegal grows that, as Californians, we really care about our, or we, most of us care about our public land and the environment and climate change and all these things. And yet these legal shops are destroying our lands because they're buying from illegal grows.
Yeah. And I mean, I have not looked at the issue of how much legal shops are buying illegal cannabis, but Paige St. John, one of my colleagues, did do quite the story earlier this year. Massive investigation where they tested tons of products of legal cannabis products, and they did find a number of. What appears to be happening is there's labs that you can go to where they'll essentially kind of green, whatever you call it, rubber stamp your testing. And so through what she was able to find, I mean, they found that there's all kinds of heavy metals and molds and all the things that you find in illegal cannabis, also in the legal cannabis supply. And so, yeah, that suggests that exactly what you're saying is happening. I mean, I think that's an enforcement issue. I think, you know, we don't put much, you know, on the hierarchy of issues facing California, you have to make decisions about what we find to be the biggest issues. And, you know, there has to be money for these things. Are there enough people looking at this? You know, are there people going out to the fields and breaking it up? And, I've been talking to people in Ventura County, and they have a pretty robust, like, going after these illegal grow operation. And it's interesting because when I first heard about it, it's like, oh, you know, illegal grow, some guy's growing a few plants in his yard or whatever, or, you know, but we're like talking about
Mexican cartels.
Yeah, Chinese, Mexican, Armenian crime syndicates and cartels, also street gangs, those type of things. And in Ventura County. Yeah, I mean, in Ventura County, they were talking about the, I think it's the Angeles National Forest out there. And, you know, apparently if you fly over it, you can just see massive grow operations, and they're guarded by guys with AK-47s and whatever. And it's like, it's pretty wild. We have a lot of wild land in California. And I mean, you know, according to the people in Ventura County, you have to like, you know, you have to be like dropped in by a helicopter, which is an extreme thing that I don't think they're doing. You know, it's like a special forces operation, or you have to hike out there. So they're hiking like 5 hours from like the public road in these places, and they get there and there's armed resistance of some kind. Like, who wants that to be, you know, like, is that our priority? I mean, it's a major operation every time you do that. And then they just pop up somewhere else, and it's highly dangerous. It costs lots of money, takes lots of time. So I don't know that there's like easy solutions to any of that stuff, but it is very interesting. I mean,
yeah. But, and people don't even know that this is happening right in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, I think a key thing for me was the realization that, okay, illegal grows sounds kind of quaint in a way, like, oh, you know, it's a grow operation. But it's the fact that these places are so wrapped up in organized crime and feeding the cartels that are causing all the problems that we're seeing with, you know, violence in Mexico and spilling over into the U.S. and all that. I mean, that's what's really disturbing, is that you're not just, you know, if you buy from your neighbor's illegal grow who's grows a couple ounces on the side, I'm sure, you know, hard to make a case that that's hurting anyone that much. But it's these huge multinational organizations getting involved. And the reason they get involved, there's so much money in it, you know, and there's an endless supply of people willing to work in these industries. So, yeah, I mean, so hopefully that's just another issue that hopefully needs to get addressed a little more.
Let's get to the story that got you and I together in the first place, which is these mushrooms. I don't know how you got my name somehow to interview me about a mushroom story. And I don't remember how that is, but I connected you with Dawn, who was also, by coincidentally, found all these cartoony mushrooms next to a school. And we got that tested. And it took a while because I wanted to do this interview a while ago. And you said, no, let's wait for you to get the story published before we have a podcast. So how did that story come about?
Yeah, so just real quick on the topic of why it took so long. I mean, basically, we did most of the reporting and then we got the testing done. And the testing took like maybe 2 months to get back. And then in that process, like the editorial process is moving. So you know, stories take a long time to get published. So this is a pretty normal process, but I appreciate you waiting because it was helpful. Now we can talk fully about it.
Good things are worth waiting for.
Yeah. So, the good news on that one is, you know, we found that, you know, they weren't full of fentanyl or anything. You know what I mean? These products, what we're talking about are basically mushroom, psilocybin mushroom, chocolates, gummies, other products that are purporting to have psychedelic mushrooms in them, whether it's psilocybin, Amanita muscaria, whatever. And I reported last year that I'd started seeing these in dispensaries, illegal dispensaries in LA. That was the first thing. No one had really reported that yet. And I mean, I'm sure it'd been on like some of these sort of like drug Instagram accounts maybe, but you haven't really seen, you know, full-throated reporting on it. And so that came out and we sort of kept an eye on that whole thing, like what's going on with that. So, I mean, you know, the first thing I saw was the big, huge jars of actual mushrooms, which, I mean, I guess you could like pour fentanyl on them or something, but the chances that that's going to be tainted seemed fairly low. So we weren't too concerned about that. But then I started seeing all these chocolates and gummies and things that were, some of which looked very flashy and really well done and like looked like a product you'd buy in the candy aisle, you know, like really beautiful artisanal chocolates and whatever. And then some of them just look like absolute, you know, just totally looked fake, like didn't look legit at all, you know. And we're saying like, well, what is the deal with these things? And we sort of started researching and talking to experts and talking to people who had taken them. And, you know, there seemed to have been a history of people having bad responses. Now, mushrooms themselves, people have a lot of bad responses. They take too much and that type of thing. So it wasn't too, we weren't hearing highly just, you know, people dropping dead, like with the fentanyl. I mean, this is more kind of just bad experiences, nausea, intense trips that they didn't intend for, that type of thing. So we ended up, Carrie and I ended up testing dozens of chocolates and candies and things and finding that many of the chocolates, I think something like 40% didn't even have psilocybin at all, which is supposed to be the active ingredient in these things. And you know, a number of them had sort of kind of like quote unquote research chemicals like 4-ACO-DMT, which is a chemical that actually essentially once you consume it basically just becomes psilocybin. So I mean, not necessarily bad, but at the same, you know, it's essentially the same thing as if you were to take mushrooms, minus there's some, you know, different feelings and things apparently, like if, you know, there's things in the actual mushrooms themselves that aren't in 4-ACO-DMT and whatever. So but the problem is not that that substance itself is so horrible and it's going to kill people and stuff. It's more that it's showing that these things are not what they're purported to be. And my stance on it is, you know, I'm not advocating that we, you know, let's arrest everyone who does mushrooms. That's not the point. And I think right now we're in a moment where a lot of people are experimenting with psychedelics and, you know, we have no interest in demonizing them in that sense. But I think one way I've put it is, I think, you know, every medication you buy has like, you know, could cause XYZ. This is how much you should take. Here's how much is in it. Why are we allowing this industry to proliferate where you have no idea what's in these things? So, you know, we found one of them was bath salts. This is supposedly a vape, very strange product that we found in a San Diego smoke shop, by the way. And, you know, Why? What the problem is, people have no idea what they're consuming, and I think you know there could be anything in these things. And you know, who's if you're allergic to something, you have a really bad reaction to something, you don't even know what you're on necessarily. And so I just think that if we're going to have, so it's interesting because mushrooms and ibogaine and ayahuasca and all the other natural, quote unquote, you know, like plant based.
Drugs.
Or fungus-based or whatever drugs, psychedelics, were supposed to be, were not supposed to be, were legalized, were passed, sorry, there's a bill to legalize them that last year in the legislature passed it. So the state house and the state senate passed this bill after first getting shot down because the police union didn't like that they included synthetic psychedelics. So they took out acid, you know, LSD. I think they took out MDMA, which isn't a psychedelic, but was also in there. And it was just these natural ones. So it was passed by the state house and the state senate. It was very clear it was going to make it through. So what happened was some of these companies started producing these products, right? And then Newsom vetoed it somewhat surprisingly. No one saw that coming. And so this industry kind of kicked into gear, anticipating in the same way that, like, for instance, when Nevada legalizes cannabis, everyone starts, it's clear that it's going to happen. So everyone starts pouring money in and whatever, right? And so this industry kind of was ramping up for it to be legal, and then it's not legal. So instead of, now you've got the worst of both worlds. You've got the industry with absolutely no regulation. And what we found was, what was most shocking to me was the dosing. So you would buy one chocolate bar from X brand that said it had 4 grams of psilocybin, and there'd be zero in it, right? And then you buy the same brand chocolate bar, but might have been made by a totally different company. Who knows who actually made it? It's just the same packaging that you can buy off the internet. And that one might have 20 grams of psilocybin in it, which, you know, if last time you took it, you only got 2 grams and it was like a nice experience. And then the next time you take 20 grams, you're going to end up in a bad situation. And so those are the type of concerns. It's not a life and death thing in the same way as like...
But it's important. It's product safety. We're a country that, you know, we're obsessed with product safety. You go to the grocery store, there's labels on everything, labels on your mattress, labels on your movies, there's labels on everything. But you go buy all this stuff and it's like, well, anything goes, no regulation. And some of the things are dangerous.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, this is one where I think San Diego is actually worse in some ways, because LA, at least it's in illegal businesses. You know what I mean? Like if you go into an illegal smoke shop, not a smoke shop, an illegal dispensary, and you, I mean, people don't know they're illegal, so this is kind of a, you know, it's still a problem. But if you go to an illegal dispensary, everything there is illegal. So the concept that it's going to be regulated, I mean, that's like by definition, it's not, here's my illegal products, please regulate them for me. You know what I mean? There's no process for that, right? But in San Diego, they're selling them in legal businesses, which is smoke shops. So I did see them in smoke shops, some in LA, but it's much more prevalent in San Diego. Almost every smoke shop we went to had them, and you know, prominently displayed. Even places where they'll have two of the bars on the wall. I mean, we were, Carrie and I,
Was there a follow-up from your reporting? So, okay, because I know that Dawn saw these things next to a school and was alerted. And then, you know, I connected her with you. We asked law enforcement to test the product, but it wasn't, for whatever regulatory reason, they couldn't do it, but you were able to test it. I'm wondering if the loop is closed, that now law enforcement comes in and shut down places that are selling bath salts in disguise of mushrooms.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to know exactly what is done in that sense. I mean, we haven't heard reports of widespread, you know, closures or anything, but, you know, and the ones, you know, I have not checked in as much on San Diego, to be fair. I've been paying more attention in LA, where I can actually go physically see these places and, you know, more readily. But, you know, in LA, like I said, the problem is these places reopen immediately. So I went, that raid that I went on in Whittier, they did find mushroom products. They actually found a gigantic bag of mushrooms, like the biggest bag of mushrooms you've ever seen. And it must have been like 5 pounds, and a whole bunch of mushroom chocolates and gummies. And they arrested someone. They don't arrest people for selling illegal cannabis typically, but they actually did arrest a woman who was working there that day, probably just a lowly clerk, not the person who's providing them or whatever, but the person who was there was charged with, or at least was arrested on. I don't know if they were prosecuted, but they wouldn't give us the name of the person, but on a charge of selling mushrooms. So, I mean, you know, they are capable of raiding some of these places, and it does happen from time to time, but I just, it's, you know, are the resources there? Is it a priority? That type of thing. Does someone have to die first? I mean, what's interesting is now we're seeing the FDA is looking at this company, Diamond Shrooms, S-H-R-U-U-M-Z, which is, you know, one of many quote unquote companies. I mean, whatever company even means in this space, because they're not legally, they're not just like, you can like drive to their corporate headquarters and they have a CEO and stuff. I mean, these are, like, so one of the biggest, two of the biggest brands are Polkadot and MK, which is short for Magic Kingdom. And they have the exact, so like you see these everywhere. Those are the biggest two in LA, I would say, or two of them. And you see the same container. It's got like really nice packaging, and it comes with like little trays where each little piece of chocolate has, you know, MK etched into it perfectly or whatever. And, you know, when you go to a store and you're an average person, you go, oh, wow, that looks like a real product. When you scan the QR code, it takes you to some kind of website. Sometimes it seems to be a legit website. Sometimes it's very clearly not, or it's a dead social media account or something. But, you know, the average consumer, even including us, when we first started doing this, like, you know, what is, these seem real, or what does real mean, though? There's no such thing. So they're all illegal on their face, but, you know, at least it seemed like there's a company behind it or whatever, some accountability. But then we've eventually figured out you can just buy all this packaging on Alibaba or Etsy or some of these other websites, and it comes with a tray with an MK etched in each one, so you can make the chocolate looks real, the packaging looks real, the QR code's all set up. So, you know, I think it's a very new field of inquiry for anyone, reporters, law enforcement, whatever. So I don't really fault them for not, I don't know how you shut this type of thing down. I mean, I think you do the same thing you've done that they've done with cannabis suspension.
They've done it. We've done a great job in San Diego. I was so proud of our law enforcement when they were, again, as an emergency physician, I see people with seizures, and I wouldn't know that there's a thing called K2 or spice unless I got that information from law enforcement. And they were able to like see where these people are coming in with seizures and go back and trace the smoke shops that are selling that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So there, I think we have that. I think that's an important type of collaboration. It goes both ways. Like, I learned the most from these agencies. But so I think that they have ways, and maybe they were. Maybe you're right. This is just so new that they didn't have their system in place to make it happen.
Well, there's like the very ground level people who are actually going into these dispensaries in California. They're like, oh yeah, it's been like that for a year. Everyone else, as soon as you get a little higher up in the chain, it's just not something that has been. It's increasingly on people's radars. The other thing that's worth mentioning in this thing, though, is as far as public health. I think what's concerning to me is that we're in this moment where mushrooms, and particularly mushrooms, but psychedelics in general, MDMA, ketamine, you know, with Matthew Perry's death, that's now been, at least that's like getting some attention as far as like, but my, you know, again, I'm not an abolitionist. I don't think we should like not be able to have access to these drugs. I think that people need more information about what they're getting. And what's disturbing to me is with the positive light that mushrooms have been cast in recently, you know, I mean, they've been around since the dawn of time. All of a sudden there's like this surge in interest with like, you know, How to Change Your Mind, that book by Michael Pollan. There's a few other major media breakthroughs on things that are positive, you know, kind of, and, you know, there are some studies out there that like, you know, mushrooms can help with, or that these drugs can help with PTSD and depression stuff. But
yeah, but there's a process for that. Like, again, that stuff is so offensive to me as a physician. Then go through the FDA.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the issue is like, that is giving them this aura of there can't be anything negative about them. And so like people are taking them on like they're, you know, going out with the guys on Tuesday, or, you know, on a Friday night, or like a girls' weekend or whatever. And like, it seems okay because it's sold in a store and it looks real. And like, that's where you're going to get into some trouble is when, you know, maybe we didn't find anything that bad in what we found. But I mean, it's, there's nothing stopping the next one from having something worse in it. Or,
yeah. So I've been a little bit of an investigative reporter myself, and heard about the association of suicide and drugs, especially in young people. And so I got the data from the medical examiner, the San Diego Medical Examiner, and the number one drug found in young people age under 25 who died by suicide was marijuana. Number one, far more than alcohol. And then for the first time, just yesterday, I got the data from the medical examiner and I saw the first young suicide with the psychedelics on that. So I think next year it'll be even more, I predict.
Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously there's a link between like existing mental health problems and, you know, why the reasoning for why people use drugs a lot of times it's for self-medicating purposes. There's some self-selection to some of that, I think. But at the same time, the biggest problem to me with psychedelics is there's especially mushrooms and LSD is that there's some association between existing mental health conditions, whether or not you know you have them, particularly like schizophrenia. There's also some evidence that this happens with cannabis, but making those worse. And so maybe the average person can take mushrooms here or there or you know, smoke weed for years and nothing will happen in that way. But the people who have these existing problems that they don't necessarily even know much about, that actually is a danger. And I think, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to say, oh, well, what's the problem with everyone smoking weed and whatever, you know, who cares? It's their life, but it does exacerbate.
It's a risk factor. We actually do have the scientific data to show the causation, not just correlation, right, of cannabis and psychosis. So it's a risk factor. That's my take in this whole thing. I just want, like you, informed consumers. So if you smoke cigarettes, you know you may get cancer, you may get lung disease. You know that. You're making you know, a decision there. People don't know that there's a risk factor, psychosis and permanent schizophrenia with using by using marijuana.
A story I did about this disorder called HPPD, hallucination persisting something disorder. I always forget what the two P's are, but very rare, you know, less than 2% of people that try psychedelics or whatever get it, but it's a permanent state of tripping. And I've interviewed a guy, multiple people, but this one guy, like every day, he's just like tripping all day, is seeing visualizations and whatever. I talked to a guy who didn't make the story because it wasn't on the record, but a guy who almost killed himself because he can't drive, he can't read, he can't, you know, do anything. Because, I mean, so very, 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 very few people get this, right? So I don't think, you know, it's very, you know, we don't want to turn into reefer madness and say if you...
Well, that maybe, I don't know so much about that diagnosis. Now I need to read more about that. See, you taught me something else. But cannabis-induced psychosis, not rare.
But I mean, I guess the point is, my point is not to comment on whether it's rare, but that we should have information. If you decide to use X drug, there should be more readily available.
I get it. That's your point. Like, even if it is rare, you should know about it, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Just right. Like, you know, if you take Chantrix, you could, you know, end up killing yourself or gain 300 pounds or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. We have warning labels. We're obsessed with warning labels for everything. Since you brought up Matthew Perry dying of ketamine and people were arrested, I got the medical examiner report. It also showed Suboxone, and the medical examiner made a point that Suboxone and ketamine are additive in nature. But I called them on it. They tested for everything under the sun except for cannabis. And and the medical examiner in LA, now you're in LA County, they exclude marijuana from these important investigations. We don't do that in San Diego. I'm able to get the data on marijuana poisonings over the year and able to show that overdoses have gone up and cannabis association has gone, you know, I can't do cause and effect, but I can show that. And you can't get that data from LA medical examiner because they specifically exclude that. I thought it's important for you to know that. Maybe put some pressure on them. We'd love to as a medical organization.
It's interesting because what about like DUIs and things like that? I wonder, they have to test for that, right? I mean, I don't know.
I don't know if they do that for DUIs, but these, like, here's an overdose.
Wow. That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, you would think you'd almost have to go out of your way not to test for cannabis. It seems.
Right. And their thought is, well, nobody dies of it. It's like, well, how are you going to know if you don't? That's what they said with tobacco.
But whether you die of it or not, you would still think it might be.
Right. I mean, and the point with Matthew,
why not test for it anyways?
Right. Yeah. Maybe I'll do a story on that. But in Matthew Perry's case, they went through and specifically touted his Suboxone and said that it's additive with his ketamine. And so if you think that that's additive with ketamine, wouldn't, and I don't know if he used marijuana or not, but if he did, that's additive with Suboxone.
It's just, even aside from all that, I just feel like it seems like why not just, what's the reason for not testing?
Right. It probably costs some more to exclude it.
I think it's an ideological thing of like, cannabis is 100% good for you and, you know, whatever. And I mean, you know, I think we've all known people who can't stop smoking cannabis. I mean, I've known people throughout my life who, you know, sources and friends of mine who just, you know, whatever, who like just, it has some detrimental effects on society to some degree. I don't think that it's, you know, causing like widespread overdoses and deaths and things like that. But I think, and I think sometimes there's a little bit of fear mongering in that way. But I think at the same time, again, I'm just all about having more information out there. What's the reason not to have the information there? And it doesn't seem that there's a defensible reason not to test for something. But it seems like drug testing would automatically test for it, just purposely not doing it.
I was thinking that may be one of those things. Well, as a physician, like trying to call them out on it and let them know that you need to do this didn't work. But maybe if a reporter called them out on it, they'd be.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I'll have to look into that.
Into doing that. But anyway, this has been, I could talk to you for more. I hope our abstract is accepted to talk about your reporting and testing at the National RX Summit. We'll see if we do, then when I get to meet you in person. And then I'm at your service if you ever need whatever information an ER doctor can tell you.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This is such a fun conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.